Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Stanley Livingston can already boost a career of more than 58 years in the entertainment industry, including a phenomenal 12-year run as Chip Douglas as one of the television's most popular and durable series, My Three Sons. The series is television's second longest-running situation comedy and has been broadcasting now continuously for 53 years. The Emmy-nominated and Golden Globe-winning show debuted in 1960 and ran through 1972. A total of 380 episodes were produced. Following its primetime run, My Three Sons immediately went into syndication, where it aired daily for the next 13 years. In 1985, Nickelodeon began airing the vintage black and white episodes of My Three Sons several times a day. The show became a smash hit with a new, younger generation. My Three Sons helped launch the TV Land Network in 1995. My Three Sons has also aired on the Family Channel, the Family Net Channel, as well as Hallmark's The Odyssey Channel. My Three Sons is also seen internationally in Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and in many countries in Europe. And My Three Sons currently airs daily on the MeTV Network. Please welcome author, director, producer, and My Three Sons, Chip Douglas, the third son of Steve Douglas on the television series My Three Sons, Stanley Livingston. Hello, Stan.
Hey, Ray.
We're doing good, man. It's been a while since we talked.
That's a heck of an introduction.
Yeah, and I had to shorten it a little bit, too.
Well, you just reminded me I needed to update that. You probably got that from my website. Actually, My Three Sons, as of this year, will be on TV 60 years.
Oh, wow.
Not 53, 60. Yeah, we're celebrating our 60th year on television, literally without going off. I mean, it airs in some way, shape, or form, whether it's on MeTV, I think it's on every morning.
Yep.
But, it's, you know, been shown locally. I guess they still have film chains or video chains that show it. And, yeah, it just keeps going on and on and on. Who knew?
That's crazy. You know, today on Fox, on the webpage, Fox News, did you see the entertainment section?
No.
Yeah, it was talking about how it was a big gamble for them to have, the actress that played with Don Grady, who's also a friend of yours, the wife of Don Grady in the episode.
Oh, Tina Cole.
Yeah, Tina Cole, how it was a big gamble for them to actually be in bed together. And they did that in the show. It was quite a gamble, but it all worked out. And they said it was like it was time to do that. You know, because nobody's ever done that, I guess. But that was...
Yeah. I mean, it's just like old television shows because of the codes that were around, you know,
right,
to protect people. I don't know what they're protecting them from, but yeah, even on Ozzy and Harriet, you know, Ozzy and Harriet had separate beds.
Yep.
You know, on most shows, that's how it was done. And I guess they left the rest up to your imagination how David Rickey came about.
But, exactly.
Anyway, yeah, My Three Sons, I that really was kind of groundbreaking. Although my descendants did, a few groundbreaking things that, I'm kind of proud of. If you look back in the earliest shows, like probably in 61, 62, 63, I think you remember Fred McMurray, his character was an aeronautical engineer.
Right.
And we were one of the first shows ever to show black people.
Yeah.
Not in the standard role you usually see them in the show, like a farmhand or, a janitor or some subservient position. But, Steve's in his office and another aeronautical engineer walks in. Guess what? It's a person of color.
Exactly. Which
back in 61, I don't know whether that just slipped by people. But, about the things that the producers of the show, were an equal opportunity employer back then, but we're kind of setting the pace for things yet to come.
You guys, a lot of people probably won't realize this until they go back and watch the episodes a couple of other times, but you guys had a lot of well-known, iconic actors who made guest appearances on the show as well. I mean, there was a lot of people.
We did.
Yeah,
I think there's a page. If you go on the internet and put in My Three Sons,
right,
put in full cast, list us, obviously, Fred McMurray, William Folly, William Demers, Don Grady, Tim Considine, myself and my brother, Tina Cole. But it goes on to list all the people who did make appearances on the show. And, it's amazing what it was. You're either one or two type of guest star. You're either, three, actually. There was people nobody had heard of before, and, they were just either starting out in the business and trying to get a credit.
Right.
There were some people that came on of the same ilk, and they were just starting out on the business and trying to, aggregate some credits for themselves, so they had a great resume. But, people like Mark Sheen, Bo Bridges, Jody Foster, mm-hmm. They were yet to have their careers. And then, as you said, there were a lot of old-time movie stars who had huge careers, Lou Ayres, Sylvia Sidney, who came on the show. And, they were in the twilight of their careers at that point and still wanted to work. And, My Three Sons was a top-rated show, so, wasn't an embarrassment to be on it. And, most of them had either worked with Fred McMurray or knew him, so that was kind of fun. But to look back, there's literally hundreds of those people.
Yeah, some of them that really stuck in my mind, Harrison Ford, George Takei from Star Trek,
Well, Harrison Ford is kind of hard to find. You have to know he's there. I forget which episode it is. Guess what? He didn't even have a line.
Really?
Extra.
Oh, man.
I think it was in a dance scene when Don Grady, Robbie's character, Mike's character, some scene where they had a lot of younger people. But if you know how he looked, you recognize him immediately. Everybody starts somewhere. That's the thing. I think I talked about that actor's journey project that I had conceived and put together.
Right.
And there was a guy that told a story in that about, how people that are huge movie stars, you have to start somewhere. It's not
sure.
Like you start as a star or even, as a recognized name. And even they who went on to produce Short Circuit and, a bunch of all the Tremors movies and quite a few other films, but earlier in their career, they were doing industrials and they were putting a retrospective together on themselves, and the editor called them in the room. They had shot something in a factory of all places.
Huh.
And, it's just the workers. I don't know whether they were, putting lug nuts on something or welding something, but the editor says, "Hey, look who's in the scene." And they were like, "Oh my God, it was Kevin Costner." So he wasn't even an actor yet. He was doing something in that factory.
That's
but,
funny.
You obviously recognize the face. And, you probably said, "Hey, if it's on camera, I'll do it." So, you do whatever you got to do in the beginning.
That's pretty cool. How the actor's journey, the series you did was fantastic. It was phenomenal. And what's up with that right now? I mean, can people still find that?
Yeah, what's up with it right now? We're kind of migrating from having been a DVD-based product to being online and having it streamable. So it's offline right now. The website's offline too, while we're making this transition to bring it up, you know, to what people want, which is to be able to watch it immediately on their iPhones or on their computers at home, or, you know, just sending it to their TV set. And I guess we'll still probably have the DVDs available if people want to buy that. Some people like me, I always like to have hard copies of stuff and hold it in my hand after the box that came in.
Yeah.
But, you know, the younger generation doesn't care about that. You know, they just want the information that's on it. So, yeah, it'll be available in about three different ways. Mm-hmm. One, you can either watch all of it, which there's 10 hours worth, which is really an education on... So people aren't confused. Not on acting, not on the craft of acting. It's totally related to the business of acting.
Right.
The other way you can do it is there were eight DVDs, so we're breaking it down that way. You can stream any one of the eight, or, you know, sequentially you can go through all eight. Or the other way to do it is you can just watch the segments you want to watch. You know, I don't advise doing it that way because some of the particular segments are built out of other segments, so you're probably not going to gain all you could gain by just skipping around as opposed to watching them sequentially. But yeah, you'll have the option to do that. It's a lot less affordable. I know it is more affordable for people to do it that way too, or to get a taste of it before maybe making the commitment. I know when we were selling the DVDs, they were, I believe the set was $229, so people were paying roughly about $30.
Right.
For each of the eight DVDs. Now, $28 isn't too bad, or even $229.
Yeah.
Is really a drop in the bucket when you consider most actors just dropped anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 on up to $100,000.
Yep.
Training in the art, craft of acting.
Right.
And then being proficient as an actor, and you're ready, willing, and able to work. Except you don't know how to get work, or you don't know what this means or that means.
Yeah.
And a lot of what we teach, you know, cuts time off that process of actually learning the industry, learning what things do mean, and how to navigate through it. So, you know, it allows the actors who've been through that program really to kind of cut to the head of the line. You know, they'll know what's going on, they know what to do and what not to do, so you don't take all these side detours that waste your time and money. So, yeah, I'm hoping within the next month that it'll be available on some platform. We're bickering with a company right now that may have it up for us on a particular platform, or, you know, whether it ends up at like Vimeo or something like that. Anyway, it'll be back up again, and I'll be out promoting it again, and, you know, hopefully it'll, you know, like I said, I think it could make a big difference.
Well, I think
in the lives of actors who are trained and prepared and ready to go, and at least they can have the confidence in the teachers who are teaching this material on the DVD, because we brought together over 100 people, not just actors, but directors, producers, executive producers, showrunners, casting directors, talent agents, talent managers. We even had the presidents of the Screen Actors Guild and the Directors Guild of America at the time, and a lot of people that sat on their boards. 45 of those people had either won or been nominated for an Academy, Emmy, or Golden Globe Award. So you're literally getting the information from the horse's mouth as opposed to your friend who may be in the industry 1 year longer than you.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we're just trying to give credible information out there.
Exactly. And you're telling the truth. You know, there's so many scams out there and people wasting their money, you know.
Yeah, we have a whole section on that, a segment, you know, all gray areas, scams and exploitation. So, yeah, there's a lot of it. When you don't know what you're doing, you're susceptible.
Exactly.
To being, I don't want to say con, but being induced to take something that sometimes the payoff really isn't there and the information is not what it should be, because it's being taught by somebody who, you know, they don't know. Even though they don't know, they're going to tell you how to do it, as opposed to people who do know and have been doing this, you know, for 20, 30 years. So
yeah,
that's the big difference.
Last time we talked, we were just talking about a project you were doing. It's called In the Picture.
That was that Cinerama project.
Right.
That was involved.
Talk a little bit about that, because I find that fascinating.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is, you know, I was in a Cinerama movie
right.
when I was a kid or a teenager. I was in How the West Was
yep.
Won, which
good movie.
Ended up being the last Cinerama anything made. And Anyway, a friend of mine restored all the Cinerama movies. He's been doing this over years.
Right.
Over the years, quite a few of them. And, you know, the early ones were like travelogues, but they presented widescreen format in the motion picture industry. Before that, everything looked like a TV set. Even when you went to the movies, it was that 3x4 format.
Right.
You know, that wasn't like what you have at home where you see widescreen,
right,
which is 16x9, or ultra widescreen, which I think is 2.35:1. So, you know, the aspect ratio is very wide. But what started that was Cinerama. And Cinerama came about in 1953, and they made, like I said, these, a little bit more than documentaries, but, you know, they were basically like travelogues. The camera didn't move much, there wasn't a story. But they were so astounding looking to the audiences back then, who were used to seeing, you know, these smaller screens. It didn't matter what movie you were in, that's the way every movie was made up right to that point, was 3x4. That it caught on, and it was a huge, huge event. I think 1953 to about, you know, 63, when these various Cinerama movies were made. They'd pull in huge audiences, and they were like an event. People would show up at the theater wearing their suit and tuxedo. you know, it was quite astounding. But what it did is it brought people back to the theater, because TV had come along in the late 40s, and people were installing television sets in their homes.
Right.
And, you know, they were luring all the movie audiences away. So they had, I think, something to get butts back into seats. And this idea of widescreen presentation seemed to fill the bill. Anyway, and it eventually evolved. The last Cinerama movie made, and for people that don't know what Cinerama actually is, it's three cameras. Mm-hmm. There's three cameras that are interlocked together, and they basically look at whatever you're shooting. So it gives you a view, a field of view of almost 180 degrees. I think it's like 172 wow degrees. So when you see that on the projected on the screen by three projectors, and there's kind of a faint line or a seam where they mm-hmm come together, but it's pretty faint.
Yeah.
It really is astounding to see, especially if you have scenes with motion where yep you're, you know, having a forward motion, because it's kind of like riding in your car, you know, when you're driving. When you're looking forward, it's just sort of static and you're driving at it, but
right,
if you look out the either side, everything is whooshing by. That's the sense you get with Cinerama, because of the curvature of the screen. So, anyway, Cinerama's been around a while, and mm-hmm I knew this guy, Dave Strohmeyer, who had just restored How the West Was Won, and they re-premiered it, I think it was in 2010.
Right.
And he got the idea to do a new Cinerama film, so approached me. I became one of the producers on it, and then he talked me into being in it. And anyway, it was kind of interesting, and I guess from just an historical point of view, I have a person who was actually in the last Cinerama movie made in 63, and then here's that same person.
How about that?
In a Cinerama movie 50 years later.
Yeah.
Kind of thought it was kind of recursive, but actually very interesting. So, yeah, we did this film. It was about 30 minutes long, called In the Picture. And we kind of took advantage of locations around Los Angeles. And anyway, how the camera came about, those, the Cinerama Corporation had about, I think it was about four or five of these cameras in various states of disrepair. And they were able to put one of the cameras back together, cannibalizing parts off some of the other cameras. So we had a camera that actually functioned, and that's the one we shot with. And the Cinerama camera is the camera you hold on your shoulder. This thing is more akin to like a phone booth with like three lenses on it. So it's quite big and quite heavy. What we didn't have was the blimp. Most cameras are blimped, but it's usually within the camera. They make enough soundproofing built into it, and
right,
the exterior of it, which is also a heavy camera too. But on a Cinerama camera, you actually have to place that camera, that phone booth, in another larger phone booth that has this big bubble on the front, and all three lenses are able to look out of that. And it's quiet enough once it's in there that you can shoot dialogue scenes. Well, that was the only thing we didn't have, was the blimp, so all the scenes would be shot. Where there was dialogue, we had to go back into the studio and re-record all the sound, you know, just loop everything that we said so that you could have a nice clean soundtrack.
Sure.
Anyway, we did it in 2012. It was done for this particular reason. The Arclight Cinerama Theater in Hollywood, this decided to put on a Cinerama festival, and they showed every single film of the Cinerama. I think there was about 12 or 13 films. There was even a Russian film made, I guess, you know, like most things we have, they stole the idea, came up with their own Cinerama camera, and made this film called Russian Holiday, I think is what it was called. And anyway, this guy David restored that too. It was really a mess. And so, yeah, for about a week, 10 days, they showed all these Cinerama films in the picture, which is the one we made, opened the festival. And, you know, it was pretty well received. We were, you know, shocked at how well it went. And it showed maybe four or five times during the festival, and then they rotated the other films, which would have been, like I said, the earlier films. This is Cinerama, right. Cinerama Holiday. There are a number of films made, like I said, using this process. I mean, they're kind of, you know, if you look at them now and you're so used to what we see now with the camera moving around,
right,
and,
right,
you know, the motion in film, when you see Cinerama, it's kind of, it's interesting if you haven't seen it before, just because of the scope of the screen and what's being shot. But in a way, you're like kind of laughing to yourself thinking, I remember there was one of the Cinerama films where they went to different countries and they kind of presented different things there. One was kind of going down, I think, a ski slope. I don't know how the heck they did it that. You know, taking this huge, heavy camera down a ski slope. But one of the other ones was they went, I think it was in Moscow or something, but they went to a symphony and the camera was in the back of the symphony and they show, you know, about 10 minutes of the symphony. But, you know, when you think about it, you're going, my God, it's a Cinerama camera. Kind of doing what a, you know, in your house, if you have a security camera,
yeah,
in the back of the room, just pointed towards the stage, and it's just showing it. So it's like, well, that was kind of ridiculous, too. But at the same time, I guess, interesting if you haven't seen it before. Or, you know, in 1953 or 55, it was pretty cool, you know, people seeing that. There's another one, I forget what it's called. Where they had mounted the Cinerama camera on a roller coaster.
Oh, yeah, I think I saw
something. That one was really exciting to see because it really feels like you're on the roller coaster, like a thing where you see where you're dipping down and coming up. But as you're doing it, the sides are whooshing by, just like, you know, you would see in a car. So you really have the sensation of motion.
Why do you think more people, you know, more the studios don't do the Cineramic anymore?
Yeah, it's not from a cost point of view, not cost effective to do it.
It's expensive.
But Cinerama morphed into, they found a way to do it in a much more streamlined way,
right.
Basically through the lens and through changing the format of the film. You know, basically Cinerama's three strips of 35mm film running through three different cameras that are interlocked.
Right.
And then in the end, you sync those back up in the projection room, and you still have to have three projectionists because, you know, if you're showing one film, it may move up and down a little bit, but it's really distracting if you have three projectors and one of the panels is not in alignment. So you have to have a projectionist there to kind of turn the little knob that if the panel raises up and it's just a little bit higher than the other one, it looks weird.
Huh.
So they just tweak it all during the projection process. What it morphed into was, well, you know what Panavision is. There was it's called Panavision Ultra 70. So they figured out a way to make these lenses, anamorphic lenses, that would take that same field of view, just a slight bit left, and project that instead of on the 35mm film. They projected it, I mean, not projected, but they captured it onto 70mm film. And then, so it's squeezed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The whole thing is squeezed onto 70mm,
right.
But it's only one lens. Now, when you go to the theater, you have a projector that has an anamorphic lens, and when you throw it through that, when you project it, it unsqueezes it, and it covers the same area as the Cinerama, you know, film projected onto a screen. So it's, you know, pretty much the same thing, but now you're dealing with one camera, one lens, so much more efficient. Two-thirds less expensive, you know, because you can actually squeeze all this on the 35mm film, too, but for the sake of resolution, they were doing it on 70mm. And it looks pretty much perfect.
Yeah.
There were only two, you know, what I would call scripted Cinerama Films, which was How the West Is Won, which is probably the best example of how it was being used. And the other one was The Wonderful World of Brothers Grimm.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't know if you saw that when you were a kid. But it was the story of the Hans Christian Andersen brothers who wrote all those fairy tales.
Right.
And, so they had that theme locked into it. I think Russ Tamblyn was in it. I'm trying to think who else. Was it Lawrence Harvey? Somebody like that. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty good, too. And they actually moved the camera around the net, even more so than How the West Was Won. But after that, they went with this other format, the Ultra 70 Anamorphic. Panavision Ultra 70 Anamorphic. And they made some other films. From that, Mad World was done that way. Trying to think what else was... was this Stanley Kubrick film where they go to the moon or go to Jupiter? Oh, shit. 2001.
Yeah, I got 2020 in my mind.
Yeah, that was shot that way, too. So
yeah, that was
they were
a good
actually
movie.
Able to fill up the screen with this image in the same way you would have seen it, on a Cinerama screen.
I tell you, Stan, I like the old way of shooting movies better. Now they're getting computer generated, and they kind of look stupid in a way when they do that. And the other thing I don't like is when it's in a dark place, you can't see anything. And that was the problem they had with Game of Thrones, on the big battle scene, with the White Walkers, because nobody could see it because it was so dark.
That is an issue with digital cameras. And depending which one you're using, I don't know what they shot with. I mean, there was probably an Arri Alexa is what I'm pretty sure was shot on, or maybe a Red.
Right.
Which was one of the first high-end digital cameras to come out. That was always the thing. It's like, how do we do this cheaper? Because film was so expensive.
Right.
The process of filming.
Yeah.
You got to buy the film. Then you shoot it.
Right.
Then you got to store the negative. Then you got to make prints off that negative so you can edit. And, once you get it all together, then you got to make other prints where when you shot it digitally, you got it and it doesn't degrade when you go from print to print. When you make a copy of a film, it degrades when you go to the next to copy just slightly. But if you're doing things like Star Wars or movies where there's effects where you're actually taking multiple strips of film and they each have something different on them, but it's all in the same scene, and it's put together, unless you have real high-end, shooting in 70mm, there's a degradation of how the film looks. So that's always like in the old days, if you notice, when they shot somebody and they had rear screen projection.
Right.
The rear screen, the background always looked grainy because of that. Unless you up the film stock to a higher, resolution like 70mm, which is very, very expensive.
Yeah.
Too, so it just wasn't done. But, everybody saw the potential in the early days of videotape, how easy it was to work with, but it was just such, crappy resolution, oh my God, it looks terrible, can't, really do this for feature films, for TV maybe.
Right.
But, over the years, they were able to get the sensors to grow in size and capture the same resolution as film, if not higher. And I think that's what people are objecting to now, is that, if you are going to shoot digital, you have the option to shoot not only in 4K, but 8K, and there's probably a couple of 12K cameras out there.
Right.
But, it's so much information that what you're saving by not shooting on film, you're now having to buy hard drives to store all this stuff on or capture it onto. So that in and of itself can be expensive. And then the look of it is what people, I think, object to. You look at it and it is so sharp, so clear.
Right.
When you're looking at a human face, you can see every pore and every pimple and everything.
It's
like, my God, it's like hyper-reality. And I think they've got to find that sensibility where it's digital, but there's the elements of film there. See, what people don't realize when they're looking at film, which was the highest resolution you could get, as opposed to high resolution digital, is in film there's this thing called bokeh. B-O-K, I think E-H is how it's spelled, or A-H.
Right.
What bokeh is, there's this milky white film over it. Even though it's sharp and in fine resolution, there's still this haze that's over it, and that's what makes film look like film.
Right.
Where when you're shooting in the digital realm, that's the one thing that's missing. It just keeps increasing in sharpness and sharpness, and it doesn't look like film anymore. That's the problem. So there has to be some way, I think, in post-production to induce that bokeh back into it, where you degrade it slightly and take some of the sharpness out, and you can make it look more like film that way from a technical standpoint.
Are you going to be producing or directing anything in the near future?
I'm working on a couple of projects right now. You know, our business, especially at my age, is, you know, always the fly in the ointment is getting the funding for things. Well, that's always been the, you know, the fly in the ointment for everybody who's got a project, you know, managed to get some done. But at the point now where, you know, you have a new project you want to go out there, it's much harder to do that. And then it's much harder to get a commitment out of a distributor.
Right.
Unless you take the risk of making something and you show them the prototype or the pilot and then they order, you know, more copies of it. So, you know, for instance, if you're doing a series, they make a pilot, you shop it to the various platforms that are there, the networks, the cable networks, and now we have all these streaming platforms with Amazon, Hulu, Netflix, so there's just so many of those. And you're hoping it's appealing or they have a place for it. So yeah, I've got a sitcom that I've been working on and trying to bring up to speed, and the script is pretty much done, and you know, we've got it out to some people we're hoping are going to become our partners, and then ultimately it'll find its way onto some either TV network or TV platform.
That'd be great.
It's just hard to know that that'll happen, you know, until you get it made.
Well, yeah, like you said, there's so many ways today. You know, I got Roku, and I'm subscribed to everything, you know, HBO, Netflix, the Roku channel, you know, and there's so many ways, there's so much to, you know, that you can put out there now, which is great.
Yeah, it doesn't mean it's any good. I mean, I think, you know, as much as people, you know, moan aloft the networks or what they once were, these powerhouse TV networks that showed everything, and that was sort of like the pinnacle of where you could be if you're on TV, and, you know, cable came along and you usurped some of their thunder, and in the final analysis, some of these cable companies became so wealthy and so powerful. In the case of, like, TV Land, you know, that started off showing, or Nick at Night, actually, I guess is where it started.
Exactly.
Where people, the guy that started that thought, hey, there's all this material that they're not showing in these libraries and archives, old black and white TV, I bet there's a market for that.
Yep.
You know, he bet the farm on that. Turned out he was right, and, you know, people started watching Nick at Night. And that's where my three sons, you know, after it had been shown for 12 years and was 15 years in syndication, it found a new home on Nick at Night. They took our old black and white episodes and started showing them again. It found a whole new audience of, you know, our kids. And then we're down to, I think, great-great-grandkids by now. So, yeah, the guy made so much money doing that he started, VH1, and what was the other one? There's the music channel and something like that, and sports channels. But they were all in the cable realm. Well, the guy made enough money. Guess what? He bought the networks that made all that stuff. This guy named Sumner Redstone ended up buying CBS.
Amazing.
You know, yeah, with the pocket change he had left over, he bought Paramount Studios.
Amazing, isn't it?
You know, he did okay taking this unwanted video that apparently nobody wanted to look at, or at least the networks didn't know what they had in their library and didn't care. So, yeah, he made a fortune doing that, and basically that's how my two sons ended up staying on TV for 60 years. We were originally on Nick at Night, and was there for about 10 years. And would show these black and white shows from midnight to 6 in the morning, and that went so well that they decided to create a whole other, you know, channel called TV Land.
Yep.
So not only my two sons went over there, and they actually started showing some of the color ones too, that all these other shows that hadn't been seen in years and years or perhaps decades went over there and found new homes, and, you know, all these younger people saw it and liked it, and, you know, or the parents of kids or grandparents of kids say, hey, you got to watch this show that I watched when I was a kid. You're really going to like this.
Yeah.
And such was the fact. So, you know, went from there. We were on, a channel called Ion, Lifetime. You know, I've Odyssey channel. I mean, so many different channels have had My Three Sons. Like I said, currently it's on MeTV. I think it's been about 4 or 5 years now.
Yep, in the morning.
You know, start showing from episode number one, which is the black and white.
Yep.
There's probably about probably about 200 of those, and then they finally migrate into the color episodes and work their way through all 380 episodes and then start over again.
And
that's one good thing about My Three Sons, you can show an episode, you know, once a day for a solid year and still have about 20 episodes left over. So.
Man, I can't believe you guys made that many episodes. That's crazy.
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, you know, in those days, that was actually kind of standard. What it was, I think it was years 1 through 3, we would shoot 39 episodes a year. So if you look at 39 episodes, if you take 13 of them and add it onto that number, you know, you're up to the year, you know, 50 episodes or whatever it would be, which, you know, that's why in the beginning, when My Three Sons was originally on the air, you would see 39 weeks of episodes, and then they would take the other 13, and, you know, you'd end up at 52. So that meant, what would that be, 13, 36, 26 episodes were never seen again after they were shown for the first time.
Huh.
And that didn't happen again until Nick at Night in 85.
Right.
So that was 25 years later. Some of those episodes had not been seen.
And you guys had to work around the McMurray method, right?
Yeah, that McMurray method was there. We didn't know what that meant. They were just experimenting with us. Yeah, we were sort of like guinea pigs of the McMurray method, which, for people that don't know, he would come in and shoot all of his scenes, or he would be in every scene. I mean, it's not like he came in and loafed. He came in at 8 o'clock in the morning and was literally in every shot. So we would shoot the master. A lot of times they would shoot his close-up, and they wouldn't shoot our close-up, but we'd move on to the next scene and do the same thing. And so Fred would do that for about 3 months, and then he would go away for the rest of the summer for 2 or 3 months, and then at the end he would come back for another 2 or 3 months and shoot, you know, the stuff we hadn't shot yet.
Right.
And then while he was gone, we would shoot all those missing close-ups and two shots so the editors
Amazing.
Could finish off the scene and, you know, get different episodes done. And, it's the way it was done for 12 years.
That's amazing.
Which was great for him, you know. I mean, he had a regular life, and I think that's the reason he was amenable to doing a TV series. Yeah, most movie stars didn't want to be on TV.
Right.
But either he saw the writing on the wall or just thought, hey, this suits my needs. He and his wife, June Haver, had adopted twins.
Mm-hmm.
They were little girls. And, yeah, he didn't want to go away doing movies where you're gone for 6 months at a pop. And this afforded him the ability to work in Los Angeles, to drive to work at 7, 8 in the morning and return home at 5 o'clock. And during the weird work week, have a regular, you know, regular job and have his weekends free. And like I said, then he would take off in the middle of the whole thing. He would go to his ranch in Montana, or he had another ranch in Northern California up there in the wine area. And I think they sold that to Gallo finally.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was his thing, and, you know, we were like the dwarfs down in the mine. We were just gone for 3 months, so we just kept on working and working, and it worked out. You know, actually, from the standpoint of, I finally got into production towards the end of it. I had my fill of acting, and when it was over, I was, 22, and I think when I was about 20, I started a production company.
Mm-hmm.
I started doing same thing, industrials, commercials, whatever, music videos, whatever we could shoot. But I learned everything that I learned behind the scenes on My Three Sons. You know, everything from the editing to cameras to film stocks to how to, you know, put a production board together so you know how to shoot.
Yep.
And, you know, the people that were teaching me this stuff were only too glad to teach it to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, taught me everything they knew and, you know, so you learn how to do it. You learn from really, really good people. I availed myself to that. And, you know, it was a great experience. So, you know, I've had that, you know,
stand.
My portfolio. Just when I went on my own, it's like, okay, I know what to do here. I know what the problem is.
Right.
That's really all production is. You know where you're going to shoot.
Sure.
What you're trying to do is anticipate all the problems that could come about that day, whether, you know, with actors or production schedules or locations and things like that. Yeah, that's what you learn.
Yeah, raising the money, that's the hard part.
It is. Well, that's what I'm saying. That's the unglamorous part of being in this business and seeing your producer. It sounds great, really. All it is, you know, you're trying to meet people and be introduced to people that, you know, are either wealthy individuals that have discretionary cash and don't mind putting it up. You know, they're going to gamble it on something anyway, and some of them have an affinity for TVs or movies and want to be part of the action, and those are usually the type of people that, you know, want to, I really loathe to use that word, invest in the movie industry, because it's not really an investment, no more so than when you go up to Las Vegas and you play poker. I mean, I guess you can look at that as an investment, but it's truly not. So you just got to like what you're doing, just how like people like gambling. You're willing to risk that money, and if it all goes bye-bye, you're okay because you had a good time. And same thing in the movie industry. Now, nobody knows what's going to happen. Doesn't matter if you're George Lucas or Steven Spielberg. You know, every time you do a project, you're rolling the dice.
Exactly.
You know, in Steven Spielberg and George Lucas's case, you know, you're talking about dice that cost north of $100 million. And you know, you try to do everything in your power to put a decent package together and hedge your bet. You know, get Harrison Ford to be in it and get the best cinematographers and best crew and all that. But in the final analysis, it's the audience that tells you whether you have a hit movie or not.
Exactly.
You know, that's the problem. You know, you can either make Indiana Jones in the movie, or you can make Howard the Duck. You get it out there in the audience looks at it and goes, hey, this is an Indiana Jones, this is Howard the Duck.
Well, Stan, I think you're due, man. I think you're going to be the next Ronnie Howard. How's that?
Well, I think that part's over, but I'll just be satisfied, you know, to work. Yeah, Ron has done really, really well.
He has, you know, but, you know, like you said,
I had a couple opportunities back there to do things that, you know, you look at yourself and go, what was I thinking?
But, you know,
that would have been a door opener for me, but, you know, you were closed off to it instead of being open to it, where he wasn't, and, you know, made a couple of crappy films for Corman, but, you know, the legitimacy of having those in, again, in your portfolio where you were the director on a feature film at any level was worth gold. Where, you know, I was looking maybe to do something above that, but, you know, those kind of films, but it was probably a miscalculation on my behalf, you know, that you just weren't going to get to do those kind of films until you've done the other films, you know, because I look back and I go, well, wait a minute, you know, Francis Ford Coppola didn't start off with The Godfather. Francis Ford Coppola started off with Dementia 13.
Right, exactly, exactly.
And that was shot in probably 3 days for Corman, so, yeah, you know.
But, you know, you and Ronnie are very similar. You started out as child actors. He learned the production part of it like you did, you know, just talking to people and wanting to learn. And, you know, I see you and him very similar.
Yeah, very similar. You know, he did some things that I didn't do. He made a short film and edited it into, I think it was Kodak, sponsored these festivals. And, you know, even him being Ron Howard, he still, you know, put his film out there and it won some kind of award, which, you know, anything you can get where people get some kind of recognition for what you're doing is gold, you know. And then so he got a little bit of money to do another one. And that led to him, well, he was still working as an actor, too. I think it was called Eat My Dust or something that he did. And his deal was, you know, yeah, I'll be in it, because Corman wasn't going to make it without him, because he had just come off American Graffiti and, you know, had a little bit of a name, and they felt would bring people to the theater. So he said, I'll let you direct it if you'll be in it. And that's how that deal got made. And, you know, doing a film for Corman at that point was, you know, even though those were B-movies, that was probably the top level of those type of B-movies, you know, so that was a good career move. You know, like I said, I had opportunities myself, and I didn't avail myself of those. I was kind of shooting for something different, and, you know, sometimes you kick yourself in hindsight and go, what was I thinking? But, you know, I look at him, and I go, you did, you know, made the right move. That's not to say it was easy for him. I mean, very, very talented, and how you can determine that, it's just not in what you're looking at on the screen, but in your taste for movies, you know, what would make a good movie, and then how to take what's there and then turn that really into something. He has the, you know, disastrous touch of that, you know, right up there with Spielberg. Look at
what kind of,
like Apollo 13 and some of the other films. Beautiful Mind. I mean, you know, he's one of the major filmmakers of all time.
What kind of movie would
hard
you?
Hard to believe, because I used to know him when he was like, you know,
I know.
6 years old, a little bit older than him.
Yeah.
You know, remember hanging out at some event with him and his dad, Rance.
Yep.
And his brother, Clint, you know, looking at him, going, yeah, these little kids are kind of bugging me, you know, because they were all, I guess, looking up to me a little bit older, so. But, you know, that's how it is. You got to keep trying, and you
right.
can't really, like, I suppose that's what I've learned. If I've learned anything over however many decades I've been doing this, is you can't have an ego about it.
Right.
You know, worth, you just got to do it. If it's no good, it probably won't be seen, or, you know, won't make any difference because it won't be seen by people that matter. And if it is good, you know, it bubbles up. It finds its way to somebody, and, you know, you can get more work off of it. So, you know, I try and do everything that comes my way, no matter what it is. Not have, you know, like I said, an ego about it or a hierarchy of, oh, this is more important than that. You just do everything. Yeah, that's just the way it is.
What kind of movie would you, if you had a chance to make a movie, what kind of genre would you do? Any idea?
Well, I like action thrillers.
Uh-huh.
I also like small movies where they're character driven.
Right.
So, either one. I've got a great script. I've actually had it for years. I pulled it back finally. I got real frustrated because I got auctioned 3 different times back in the early 1980s, mm-hmm. about the mid-1980s. And it's a great story. I mean, it's a, you know, great story to make a movie out of. It's about these con men who sell the Eiffel Tower and scrap metal to, like, these German industrials who are preparing for World War II.
Right.
And, you know, it has a motive behind it. It's kind of a revenge motive on this guy. But, you know, it's an action thriller comedy. And it culminates, obviously, at the Eiffel Tower where they're getting ready to blow it up. And anyway, I don't want to give too much away. But, yeah, it's got some real twists and turns and a surprise ending. And, you know, it's, I think it would make a great film.
Could it be a mini series like on Netflix?
Well, that's what happened to it before. It really couldn't. And again, like I said, I should have been happy that they were going to try and make it into a mini series with one of the networks. Actually, it was optioned for a while by my ex-boss, this guy named John Stevens, who was our production manager, who in today's world would have been the producer of the show, at least a line producer who, you know, effectuated the whole show, dealing with the actors, dealing with the production problems. And he went on to produce the last year of Gunsmoke and How the West Was Won when it was done as a TV series, and Simon and Simon, Major Dad. Anyway, he just, you know, wrote it, gave it to him just to, you know, get a critique. Because John, even though he was a really good friend and a mentor to me, you know, it was brutal sometimes with, like, his evaluations of things. And, you know, it wasn't like he's trying to hurt your feelings. But, you know, what you learn back then is you got to be open to all these changes.
Right.
We ended up, I got the script kind of where he wanted, and, you know, he took it and went to some networks with it. And we had interest from one of the networks.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then it came back, they were like asking me if I would be willing to stretch the story out and turn it into a 2-part miniseries. And my objection was, I'm going, it's a thriller. You know, having 2 hours of thrills and chills is one thing, but when you add another 2 hours in there, what is it really then? You know, you can't sustain that.
Right.
And I said, it's, you know, my analogy was, I said, it's like having, you know, a great glass of wine. You're pouring this great wine out of a bottle.
Uh-huh.
And you're down to the last glass and go, wow, it's so good. Gee, you know what? I'm half done with it. I wish I had a whole glass. So then you add a half a glass of water to it. So, yeah, it's that wine, but now you diluted it. And it's not, is it really that wine anymore? You know, it's not what it once was. It's diluted by adding more of it.
Yeah.
And that was my feeling with the story, that it wouldn't hold up. And so, you know, I kind of froze it and wouldn't sign off. I don't know. I probably should have done it, like I said, just to get the credit.
Sure.
Had I had that credit, would have, you know, who knows what that might have meant or which career trajectory I would have been on. But, you know, I think when you're younger, you're just more set in your ways and stubborn. And, you know,
sure.
I think even
Right.
And then guess what? You move on.
You move on, right. Well, it's still there. You still have it. You still have the script. So, you know, it's still a possibility.
I still have it. Sitting there. I keep telling myself I'm going to go down to my little office here. And,
right.
Yeah, it'll probably take me about 2 or 3 days, maybe 4 days. I'm not the fastest typist in the world. To take it from the realm of paper into the digital world where it's a lot easier to work on. Cause I think that was the other little problem for me. I had rewritten the script.
Right.
Probably 5-7 times. We're talking, you know, 120 pages in the old days when you're working on a typewriter. You know, you put a piece of blank paper in there, and then you press the first button, the first letter.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you go all the way to the last page. Well, you know, when you're rewriting, you have to open it up and put new scenes in or new dialogue in, and you're removing things. And it's just a nightmare in the paper realm. And, you know, finally we had word processors, and now we have computers that do that seamlessly. You know, you can insert dialogue anywhere, or you can say, gee, I want this scene number 5 to be actually scene number 55 now, and grab the whatever 3.5 pages of that scene, and, you know, within 2 seconds it's all moved, and oh yeah, your script's no longer than it was to begin with, you know, and you can keep the page count the same, so.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's what I gotta do, is sit there, go through it, and make whatever revisions I can make then, and then sit there and analyze it. To me, script writing, you know, the way I work anyway, is I have to know the story before I sit down and write. So, it's a lot of thinking that goes into it, note-taking and conceptualizing it, and what the scene's gonna be about, perhaps a little bit of the dialogue, but, and what the point of the scene is. Then I sit down and I start at page 1, take all those notes and put it together. And then you've got, you know, what I like, Zero Sculptor. To me, at that point, that's like when you got the clay and brought it in your place and plunked it down. Now you've got that blob, and now you shape it into whatever work of art you're going to try to shape it into. So that's how I work.
Yeah, and then you tweak it a couple hundred times.
Once I know where I'm going.
Yeah.
I think a lot of writers make a mistake. They sit there and start typing and think it's going to go. I mean, you know, then that probably in an experimental way could be interesting. But I think for screenplays, like, you know, you can go any which way, and it's like taking a trip in a car. You got to kind of know where you're going.
Exactly.
And then the things that happen on the way become what the story comes about.
Right.
Whether you get detoured or never make it there, or you have this unexpected adventure. You know, that's how movies are, too. They start off, and there's an intention. You think you know where it's going, but in a movie, it better not go there. Something else better happens. Otherwise, you lose your audience, or you're just telling them what they already knew.
Yep. Well, I think good things are going to happen to you. I really do. You just got to get that.
Oh, thank you.
You got to get that one show on Netflix or something first, and just roll with it.
Yeah, you know, whatever comes up next day, I'm grateful for it. So, you know, if it's meant to happen, it will. And that's the other thing I've learned about it in this business. While you're working on the things you want to happen, other things come your way, and those are actually the things you usually end up working on.
Yep.
You know, occasionally something you were working on goes, you know, only because if you had success somewhere else, you know, the question always is from other producers, what else have you got? You know, sort of like, you feel like you're in the garment business or something. You're like, gee, what's in your fall line this year? You have an action adventure or a romantic comedy.
That's funny.
You know, pull out of your suitcase. So, yeah, I've got all those things. I mean, I've got scripts, like I said, that are that action adventure thing. I've got a sci-fi action adventure, heavy on more on the sci-fi. You know, I've got a almost like a horror film, I guess you'd call it, kind of like in the vein of Halloween. There was this guy that I had heard of back in Utica named Johnny No Face. And just the idea of it, so I wrote something around that, actually around the same time. Then I've got another film that I went to China for that ultimately didn't get made either. We hooked up with the wrong studio who turned out not to have as much money as we thought. Yep. Had a great backlog and a lot of props and great stuff, but no money.
No.
That ended up falling through back in the 1990s. But it kind of got resurrected again lately because I have an Asian guy that works for me as a broker. And, you know, we've had some interest in it to shoot it again in China because it's based on a true story actually took place there. So who knows? Whatever one goes is the one I'm on next.
Well, you won't have any problem finding the right actors. That'll be easy for you.
Yeah, I never really worry about that. You know, that's why when I, you know, put these these packets together to show investors. Well, where's the letters of intent from the actors? I'm like, you don't need one of those.
No.
Because they're not worth the paper they're written on.
Right.
Because by the time you give me the money,
yep.
they'll be off on some other project that won't be available.
Right.
Yeah, usually what I do is I put what I call a wish list, maybe about 10 actors together that
sure.
I think could fulfill the part. Yeah, but that's another trap that you find out if you're, you know, trying to raise money and you're a producer, that if you have it all based on Harrison Ford being, you know, your main guy or, you know, Brad Pitt or something, and he's unavailable, there goes your deal. So
mm-hmm.
you got to have people looking at it with the idea that it could be any one of these 10 people and
right.
they will all suffice.
Stanley, what happened to the My Three Sons house?
It's still there. There is one real house. It's down in the what they call the Wiltern area,
right?
Which is kind of near where the studio by Paramount. It's just south of that. I think just above Wilshire Boulevard with the Beverly Boulevard, and then just east of where we used to shoot. And I did buy it. Actually, at one point, in fact, it was right after I did the actor's journey, I was thinking, God, you know what I should really do? Is do like a little documentary on My Three Sons. Of course, I wouldn't have been able to have Fred in it, but at that time, Doc Grady was still alive, you know, Jeff Barry, Tina Cole, Beverly Garland, Don
right.
Lynn, Tim Considine, and do it. And one of the ideas I had was to bring a camera, you know, kind of how they do the reality shows, that would follow me around and go up to that house and knock on the door, and just whatever the reaction would be, either, oh my God, you're the guy in My Three Sons, and say, did you know you're living in the My Three Sons? And they would either say yes or no, or, you know, they could.
The reason I mentioned about the house is because, you know, the Bradys, they just restored their house, and that was, did you see that? The Brady Bunch restoring their home?
No, I knew they were doing it, but I didn't watch any of it. And, you know, to be honest, I was probably older than when the Brady Bunch was on. My daughter watched it.
Right.
I didn't really watch it. So, yeah, no, you know, it sounded like a good premise. In fact, it's interesting. When at one point we had a proposed redo of My Three Sons, I think it was in the early 1990s, I was actually meeting with somebody at 20th Century Fox about this sci-fi film that I had.
Right.
And, you know, I came in as a writer. They knew me as a writer. And then in the middle of the conversation, about a half hour in, one of the guys said to me, he goes, where do I know you from? You look really familiar. And so, you know, I said, well, I used to work as an actor. And I told him. And then, anyway, after that, there were my sci-fi film. All they wanted to talk about was My Three Sons. And then one of the guys said, is there any possibility of maybe doing a My Three Sons redo? And I said,
right.
Well, yeah, you know, want to go that route. Actually, I said my brother and I had cooked up an idea to be able to do a remake of it,
right.
and have an idea where we live in, you know, North Hollywood, which is where the cast ended up, but a lot
mm-hmm.
of people remember the earlier part of the show where we lived in Bryant Park and had a house there, and the show revolved around us going from North Hollywood back to Bryant Park to fix our original house up that's in a state of disrepair.
Oh.
And it was basically an excuse to bring in old footage. Like, hey, remember when we were in the dining room and Ernie threw a cake at Uncle Charlie? You know, then be kind of able to show those clips from the old show and, you know, bring Fred McMurray into it via, you know, the clip so he would be included in the show. And as an homage to Fred, maybe. But, yeah, maybe someday. I it'd probably be really hard to get that going because Don's gone. I don't know whether it would fly
yeah.
with Terry, Tim, and I. But, you know, who knows? Life is strange.
You know,
it's a good idea.
I see Barry a lot in a lot of different
yeah.
type shows. He pops up a lot.
Barry works a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we can, you know, doing a Bosch or I just saw some. He's got about 7 singings in the can that are coming out in, you know, probably the next 6 months.
Yeah.
The TV shows that he did. I think he was in a Christmas show that just aired. He's a, you know, what they call a working actor, which
right.
is kind of what we all aspire to be. That's the next best thing you can be if you're not going to be a movie star, you know, at that level. But if you can at least be a working actor, that's
right.
the goal, you know, a working character actor. And he's kind of done enough stuff now that I think the industry has some respect for what he does, and they hire him for the way he looks and what, you know, kind of parts he plays, which
mm-hmm.
is what you want.
Yeah, Barry does have a certain look, you know, for
yeah,
certain roles.
Yeah, he looks like everybody's doctor or
yeah.
Elton or, you know, attorney or
right.
something like that. And yeah, he does those parts really well.
Yep.
You know, he's managed to ditch the Ernie thing.
Yep.
Plus he puts it on a toupee, which he never does anymore. But yeah, you know, in fact, that was probably the best career move my brother ever made, was losing his hair. He wasn't working as much. He looks, you know, even now if he put it on, he probably looks 10, 20 years younger, which he probably wouldn't get hired.
Yeah, probably.
He get hired on now.
Well, tell him I said hello. The last time I spoke to him was when we talked about his book, when his book first came out.
Yeah. Right, right.
Great
yeah,
book.
The Importance of Being Ernie.
Yeah. Great stories in
yeah,
that
well,
book.
Well, Ron, yeah, you just remind me, I got to update my website. I've kind of neglected it the last couple of years, just doing other stuff. But yeah, I've got that StanleyLivingston.com.
Yeah.
Website where, you know, people can find out what I'm doing or what
yeah.
I'm about to do or what
sure.
I just did and
yeah.
historical stuff and links to Barry and all that.
Well, it's a great website. It's a great website because you got everything on there. Everything.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little mixed bag of history
yeah.
and contemporary things. And I think it's got a link. I also have a production website, too, if people want to
yeah.
see the projects that I'm involved in or developing. If you go to firstteamproductions.com.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's kind of a list of stuff that, you know, some of the projects that I've been involved in and then some of the ones we're right now working on, so.
Plus, you got your artwork, right? Are you still doing that?
I haven't really done, yeah, much with it, just because of, you know, just all the other things I've been involved in.
Yeah.
Became a grandfather, so that was
congratulations.
Exciting at the end of the year. Yeah,
all right.
I can't believe that. And yeah, I mean, I'm starting to look at myself and go, wow, I'm older than Fred McMurray was when the show ended.
Oh, man. I know. Life flies, man. Life goes by.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I appreciate you having me on.
Sure.
No, we'll have to do this again.
Well, let's keep in touch. I want to know what you're doing as far as the production side, and I really wish you a lot of luck. I really think you belong doing a mini series, and you know, you got the talent to produce movies and do all kinds of stuff. You just need that, need people with money, I guess.
Well, we find them occasionally, but from your mouth to God's ears.
Stan, is there anything else you wanted to talk about, or is there anything else you want to promote?
I think pretty much covered it.
Okay.
Yeah, like I said, appreciate you having me
sure.
on and giving me a platform.
Of course. Anytime,
yeah.
man.
Anybody
Anytime.
That's interested, you know, they'll hear all about it on your show. Or
yep.
like I said, they can hop on over to either StanleyLivingston.com or FirstTeamProductions.com
yep.
and keep up with me.
Exactly. I want to thank you, man, for being on the show today. You know, the best to you and your family, the new grandchild. Have a wonderful 2020.
And you too. You have a great one. Great. Thanks again, pal.
Yeah. All right, Stan. Take care, man.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. For more information about Stanley Livingston, visit www.stanleylivingston.com and www.stanleylivingstonart.com. Very special thanks to the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsom of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, you can contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. And please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. And my new book is finally out, entitled The Rockstar Chronicles. Chronicles truths, confessions, and wisdom from the music legends that set us free. You can now order yours on hardcover or ebook at Amazon.com. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my other books, in Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business. You can also find that on Amazon.com. I promise you'll live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at PublicityWorksAgency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on PBS Radio, Station 1.